Hi, Patrick here with a blast from the past with Charlie Chan. You know, that fiendishly brilliant Chinese-American detective whose English is, well, less than brilliant.
Please, you must not worry. Everything now in lap of gods. Very soon I give very hearty shove. Perhaps clue fall off of laps.
Your idea is partly right, Mr. Chan. If this test doesn't work, I'm afraid the experiment has failed, sir.
No experiment is failure until last experiment is success.
Ooh, so profound. So foreign. The actor, by the way, was neither Chinese nor American. He was Swedish. Now, of course, today, we're not so condescending in the way we depict Chinese people, right? Right? Listen on. We'll be talking about that, along with four other language-related stories that, in some cases anyway, have snuck under the news radar. That's all coming up. Here in the studio with me is cartoon queen Carol Hills. Hi, Carol.
Hey, Patrick.
It's been far too long.
It's been a really long time.
What have you been doing?
Just the usual.
Stuff.
Cartooning. Cartooning and interviews and just the usual stuff.
Yeah.
The usual stuff in this new multimedia, three-dimensional world. We're no longer audio. We have to be video world. Blogging and tweeting and tumbling and...
Tumbling!
It's exhausting. Yeah. I never took gymnastics and it's been really tough.
Well, it's great to have you here. And we have five stories that, well, let's hope that listeners haven't heard about all of them, or at least that we can cast some slightly different light on some of them.
Because in this multimedia world, they're barraged every minute with new information.
That's right, yeah. But on the other hand, the great thing about being tweeted stories, and I tweet stories all the time, so I'm just as bad as anyone else. The great thing is that nobody ever reads beyond, a graph or two. So we have in this case. So we can now become the experts. You have story number five.
I do. And it's a new iteration of an old story, which is the Dictionary of American Regional English, which has been in the works since the 1960s. But the news is that they've finally finished it. S to Z is complete. So the whole thing is done. So we're going to be introduced to words like whoopin' soccer, upscuttle, strubbly, and swivet. We'll get the meanings a little later. But the origins of this dictionary are as interesting as the latest and final edition, which is there was a guy at the University of Wisconsin in the 1960s. He has since died. His name was Fred Cassidy. He was there forever. He died in 2000, and he was 93. Mm. And he was there for decades, and he started this project. And they literally sent out sort of, word wagons. They sent people over a period of about 3 or 4 years. They spread them across the U.S. to like 1,500 communities in every part of the U.S., every corner, to find out regionalisms and record and talk to people and find out different words for different things. So they go out and get all this stuff. It's kind of like Darwin going to the Galapagos. He does it in the 1830s, but the book doesn't come out till the 1850s.
Oh, yeah.
So they collect it all in the 1960s, but it's only in the past probably 15 to 20 years that the dictionary has been gradually coming out from, A, and now we're finally S to Z. So they took them like 30 or 40 years to cull through them, study them, probably bring them up to date. But it's really cool.
Yeah,
I mean,
that's
just
great.
Cool.
I love the idea of collecting these words through sending cars out and stuff.
It's like the old equivalent. It's like Fidel Castro, literacy, but it's like finding out about words.
Right, as opposed to telling people which ones to use. It reminds me in a funny old way of like an old-fashioned version of Google Street View or something, those cars they sent out with cameras.
So it's cool. So some of the new words that we're getting to know now, because this final edition is out, are things like schnibble.
What does that mean?
And there's a lot, I have to say, a lot of the German words. I mean, University of Wisconsin is in Wisconsin.
Right.
I mean, I think they took care all around the world, but there seemed to be a lot of German-ish words, which may reflect the times of the 1960s, but the German influence in the Midwest. You see it a lot, at least in the words you can find without accessing the whole dictionary, which I haven't been able to do. So you have things like schnibble, which is a scrap, a small piece.
Yeah.
Schnickelfritz.
What's that?
Schnickelfritz is sort of a, little boy, little Schnickelfritz. Then they do a lot of the regional differences. This is an old chestnut, but, sandwich. Po' boy in Louisiana, hoagie, sub, grinder, hero, or torpedo, different places. So those are, when you look at some of these words, what's cool is that some of the ones have worked their way into common parlance.
Yeah.
In some cases, because of people travel a lot, the influence of kind of national sort of TV, radio, and new media. A lot of words that used to be very regional then are introduced either through fashion or food or something. So some of these things like, you know, Zydeco, we all know what Zydeco is now. Perhaps maybe 50, 60 years ago, not as many people went to New Orleans to visit, that right. kind of thing.
But I got to say, I didn't know. I mean, that list of sandwiches, they're all sandwiches, right? Are they different? Is what is inside those sandwiches different?
I think po' boy, I can't remember. I've been to New Orleans once. I think po' boy might be a little bit different. But basically a torpedo and a sub and a grinder are the same thing.
Oh, I had no idea. There
you go. And a hero, yeah.
Oh, a hero. I thought the hero came from the Greek, you know, the G-Y-R-O.
No, I don't know. I mean, it was when I was growing up, it was H-E-R-O. I mean, I'm from northern New York, and so it would be submarines. Mm. Sometimes you'd see heroes. And then one time I spent a summer in Connecticut, and I went into a place, and they had grinders, and I ordered one. Turned out it was a big sub.
Yeah, that sounds nasty. I don't think I'd want a grinder.
Grinder, that's kind of almost disappearing. I mean, if you go to coastal New England, you still see grinders up into parts of Rhode Island, but you just don't see a lot of it.
It's not a very attractive.
No. But, and I think also national chains, you know, Subway, a lot of things maybe have eroded the regional.
a national train called Grindr. Get your grinders here. I don't think that would. No.
But they do, you know, other regional comparisons they do is like, you know, when you have dust under the bed and they're little like dust.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I would call them dust bunnies. Fluff. Like fluff under the bed is, that's the generic term. Mm. Dust kittens in the Northeast. Uh-huh. Dust kitties. I've never heard dust kitties, and we live in the Northeast. Dust bunnies in the Midwest. I say dust bunnies, and we're in the East. House moss in the South. And woolies in Pennsylvania.
Woolies? House moss. You could almost have like moss is damp, and you know it's all humid down in the South. That makes sense.
And then I feel like I have to explain the meanings of those words I said at the top of this, which was whoopinsocker, upscuttle, strubbly, and swivet. Well, whoopinsocker, it's something sort of extraordinary of its kind or something large, like a strong drink. That's a whoopinsocker.
That's a whoopinsocker scotch you have there.
Upscuttle, it's a southern Appalachian term for a noisy quarrel. You know, loud argument is an upscuttle. Strubbly, it's a Pennsylvania German term or Pennsylvania Dutch term, as we call it, for untidy. It's a very strubbly house. It's untidy. And swivet, it's a term for a state of anxiety from the South.
I mean, the great thing about American English is even Americans, I would imagine, certainly somebody like me, an immigrant like me, is that it's just unending. The neologisms come from all over the world. These mashups between these words that immigrants have brought with them and local ones. And it's just perfect for the language to just keep coming up with new words, to keep reinventing itself. There also seems to be a kind of tolerance for non-standard English in this country, which I think a lot of people abroad and in other parts of the English-speaking world might look down upon, but I think it's wonderful.
It is amazing, and I think actually digital media has really accelerated the speed in which we adopt words. And I think also there's been sort of a casualization of speech.
Yeah.
And just over my working life, the type of language you see written in something like the New York Times, it's different now. It's much more casual than it was 25 years ago.
Right.
I remember years ago, I would read The Economist, say, the British magazine The Economist, and think, oh, they're so chatty. And there was this very chatty British kind of style. Mm. And that chatty style is much more prevalent in American press now. It used to be, like New York Times 25 years ago was much more formal.
It was starchy.
Now just kind of chatter, the way people speak, a conversational tone is almost required or it's highly desired.
Right. Into that, it's just easier for new words to
absolutely.
Work their way into that style.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right. On to story number four. And we're going to stay with the English language now, I guess, very much stay with the English language, because on both sides of the pond, there have been talk from opinion makers that it's really not worth learning any other languages because English is just king and just forget all about it. And this is,
oh boy.
You know, you hear this from time to time, but it was interesting to see it almost that this was being brought up both in Britain and in the United States by, you know, by people pay attention to, and they were using a lot of the same arguments. In Britain, there were several articles, but the most ridiculous one in a way, but possibly also the most widely read one, was in the Daily Mail by a guy called David Thomas. Let me just quote from his article. "Learning foreign languages is a pleasant form of intellectual self-improvement, a genteel indulgence like learning to embroider or play the violin." It makes it sound like something that takes place in a parlor in Victorian England.
It takes place in Downton Abbey.
Oh, Downton Abbey. Yeah, that's right. "A bit of French or Spanish comes in handy on holiday." I mean, he's just trying to annoy people like you and me, I think, here. Then he actually does take on things like Chinese, which clearly there's a lot of interest in learning right now and with the rise of China and all of that, and says the only problem with Chinese is that it's not spoken by anybody who's not Chinese. Of course, this is a snapshot of a certain moment, which is right now, and he has a point that not many non-Chinese speakers speak Chinese, but a growing number are. And we have no idea what's going to happen in the future.
Well, there's also 1.5 billion Chinese. Yeah, and there's Chinese communities, there's a Chinese diaspora all over the world.
But he would trump this always with the fact that English is the business lingua franca, global blah, 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 the language of science, commerce, politics, aviation, popular music, all of that kind of stuff. And therefore, this gives English a magical quality. He actually uses that term, magical. It's also a very convenient thing at a time when schools in Britain and in the United States are tightening their belts. There were cuts specifically targeted at foreign language learning from the U.S. Department of Education, similarly also in Britain. So it almost kind of justifies what our political representatives are doing. The other person who made this claim in a slightly different way was Lawrence Summers, formerly.
Yes, he of the provocative...
Yeah, yeah. He likes to throw a little petrol on the fire.
He likes to throw a little intellectual petrol on the fire.
He most certainly does.
Formerly president of Harvard.
Formerly treasury secretary, too. So he's been around the block. So people tend to listen to what he has to say. And here's what he says. He doesn't say it in quite as entertaining a way as David Thomas does. His language is a little more corporate and stodgy. But here's what he says. "English's emergence as the global language, along with the rapid progress in machine translation and the fragmentation of languages spoken around the world, makes it less clear that the substantial investment necessary to speak a foreign tongue is universally worthwhile." Yeah, he could use a little line editing, I think.
Hmm.
"While there is no gainsaying the insights that come from mastering a language, it will, over time, become less essential in doing business in Asia, treating patients in Africa, or helping resolve conflicts in the Middle East." I love the way he stereotypes all these regions of the world. Like, Africa's only there for, you know, non-Africans to help. And then in Asia, you're there, you make money. And in the Middle East, you sort out, you know, like, war. Anyway, the New York Times decided to do, based on this opinion piece that he wrote, the Times decided to gather together a bunch of people. Now, I'll put a link to that at theworld.org/language. They got a bunch of people from a variety of backgrounds to basically diss what Summer says, from a business perspective, from a cognitive perspective, from a linguistic, educational perspective. I almost don't need to go into it because it's been something we've talked about an enormous amount on the pod before.
Yeah.
It's almost indefensible what he said. And the idea that machine translation is going to solve all of these conflicts in the Middle East, health crises in Africa, and all business opportunities in Asia, it's just completely absurd.
Well, machine translation, at least the group that's doing the best, is Google. And Google's machine translation is reliant on human translation.
Without a question of doubt. Yeah.
The whole thing is processing and chewing up and spitting out the best human translation that they come up with. It's not that machines are learning to translate languages. And so you need humans who can translate languages.
Yeah.
So you need humans who know other languages.
Yeah.
It's just kind of really hard to swallow that as an intellectual point of view, as well as a pragmatic thing to recommend. It just doesn't make sense to me.
It just seems like a really odd thing at a time when Americans are really debating, not just Americans, all over the world. People are thinking, has the age of American hegemony, you know, is it passing? Is the baton being handed or grasped from the U.S. by the Chinese and the Indians and other rising powers? And to think that it's being suggested that, oh, we'll let those other people, those other rising powers, learn the languages or speak two or three languages, and we'll just speak one language, but we'll be at an advantage over them because we speak one and they speak more than one. I mean, it just beggars belief. It's astonishing.
Yeah, I don't get it.
Okay, well, Carol, you have story number three.
Yes. And it's about China, and it's about names. Specifically, the names that orphanages give to babies and children who are typically abandoned, they're brought to the orphanages. They're given names by the orphanages, and those names are with them if they remain in China for the rest of their lives. Now, traditionally, some orphanages were given these children surnames like Guo or Deng, and they, by simply having those names as part of your surname, it betrayed the fact that you were in the care of the state or the party.
Which meant essentially that you were an abandoned orphan.
Yeah, that meant you were an abandoned orphan, and that would kind of dog you for the rest of your life. And people would know this thing about you that in many ways is private. Over the years...
And we should say that, I mean, it's partly because there are so few Chinese surnames, right? Or there are so few common Chinese surnames, yeah, that if you have one that isn't one of those common ones and sounds kind of like red, yeah, then the chances are, yeah, it's been given you by the government.
It's like you're being named Patrick Government.
Or Battleship or something. Yeah. A Battleship of the People.
So many orphanages in the past, you know, 10, 15 years have abandoned this, but some still had it. And so basically the Chinese government has said, we're not going to do that anymore. Mm. And in China, the government runs adoption. They have a whole department. And so they've issued this new rule that children who are taken care of in orphanages and who are abandoned at orphanages the orphanages will choose one of the 100 most Chinese family names, like Zhao and Sun and Li and Wang and Feng. So you and I both actually, we saw this story. We both were sort of interested because we both happened to have a child from China. And so when we adopted, each of our children had a name given by the orphanage.
Yeah, and they'd literally look through the dictionary of, I mean, the last name, the surname is from my daughter's name. It was from the town where she was found, as were everybody at that orphanage. They were all had that last name, and then their given names were culled from a dictionary, and they would just go through, they would turn a page in the dictionary every day, and the new baby would get a name, you know, like we say, it was very sort of patriotic.
Yes.
But not necessarily names that would be given to...
That parents would name their children if they gave birth to a child. Yeah. Yeah, and our daughter's name was, her surname was part of the name of the town. And I guess that was an improvement upon these older names of, you know, government and, you know, party. I don't know anybody who's adopted a child from China who had that as a surname. But I think but even these geographic names, they're no longer going to be used. So it's kind of an interesting thing. And it says a lot about, the structure of Chinese names and how surnames have developed in China. There are these, you know, relatively for the number of people in China, a small number of surnames.
Right. And for the huge number of people,
And it's also recognizing, at least what the articles are saying, it's recognizing the role of psychology and how things can impact somebody. And so it's seen as a big improvement. There's a guy whose blog I follow who researches a lot of these issues, and he said that in practice, most orphanages had stopped doing this, at least the government party types. And so it's sort of been informally phased in, and now it's official.
Yeah, it sounds like, you know, there are certain provinces that are known in China that are known as kind of red provinces. And those were the remaining ones where they were getting these patriotic names. And it's also an indication, presumably, that the government is aware of the fact that it needs to normalize the situation as much as possible for these kids.
Yes, yes. They just, they're regular kids. Give them a regular name and...
Yep. Okay, so story number two. Let's go back to you for story number two.
Story number two, another story not out of Asia, but about Asian actors in the U.S. And it's about how casting calls for acting roles that require or desire Asians are still very stereotypical. They're stereotypical in the actual casting call ad, and the roles that they're looking for continue to play into stereotypes. And some of them recently have caused a stir, or maybe we should use the new word we learned, squibble or something.
Oh, yeah.
a loud argument. I can't remember what it was. In blogs. There's one blog, Angry Asian Man, which really keeps on top of, particularly in the media, stereotypical Asian casting and or just kind of racist things that go on. And I found another blog called Discretion.
Discretion. Oh, that's a good one.
that does monitors the same thing. Mm. So in Angry Asian Man, they put up the casting call for this low-budget movie that's being cast called Blood Games. And they were just aghast at the kind of Asian characters they were trying to cast. The names were as funny as the funny, sort of not ha-ha, but just sort of jaw-dropping funny, mm-hmm. as anything else. So one person they're looking for, the person would play a character called Master Splinter. This is in the ad itself, the casting noticed. You know, the name is Master Splinter, co-star, male, 40 to 70, Asian. He is your average karate master from every movie. That's one part of the casting call. The next character they're looking for, there's someone to play Miso Soup. That's the name of the character. Co-star, male, 20 to 35, Asian. He is one very sneaky Asian tour guide. He is pretty short and is always trying to speaking English and failing at it hard.
Oh,
that's
God.
The casting call. You get the idea. Sort of raging stereotypes. So all these kind of things get people going in the blogosphere. And interestingly, a much more popular show, Two Broke Girls, it's a comedy on CBS, they've been really criticized for casting a character who's the restaurant owner.
Mm-hmm.
And the character's name is, his name is Han Lee. He plays a Korean restaurant owner. In the show, he changes his name to Han Bryce Lee as opposed to Han Bruce Lee, just mm-hmm. so, you know, again, he's making this kind of goof, but he's trying to, you know, play on the Bruce Lee action figure thing. And he runs this restaurant, and his English is bad. So the blogosphere has really been going after the producer. And the producer himself was confronted, and you know, this is awful.
Yeah.
And he's just sort of saying, you know, we're a sitcom, and I'm gay, and I, you know, understand. Mm. And we're just, you know, this isn't mean. This is, you know, so he's sort of defending it. But what's interesting is that Two Broke Girls, just in January, put up a casting call for a character who's going to appear in a particular episode. And Angry Asian Man blog immediately posted it because the casting call is for a character named Edwin. Here's how it reads. 22 to 32, a hot Asian guy. He's the web designer for the girls' cupcake site. Clearly, he and Caroline have a thing for each other. And after hours at the restaurant, things quickly heat up between the two. So, like a week ago, they hire a guy for it.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, he really is hot, frankly. I don't know if you should keep that in this thing, but Angry Asian Man is very pleased with their choice. And it's this actor named Tim, I don't know how you pronounce his last name, C-H-I-O-U. Anyway, on his Facebook site, he describes himself as a proud gamer and cycling enthusiast, advocating increased awareness and outreach for both communities. I assume he means Asian and non-Asian. But on his Facebook page, he also says, much props to angryasianman.com for blowing up my site and sharing the news. All I have to say is, aw, shucks. Because they kind of went nuts, and his site doesn't work anymore, his own personal website. It's sort of interesting on a number of counts, which is just the power of the blogosphere, that these things even get going.
It also speaks to this thing that comes up again and again when it comes to discrimination and as sort of just like laughing, one group of people laughing at another group of people. There's clearly, as there should be, there are places for people to laugh at themselves, for a group of people to laugh at themselves. You know, you think of like Margaret Cho doing her mom, you know, and stuff like that. I've certainly been sent a lot of things by Asian friends of mine where they kind of laugh at maybe a broken English thing or, you know, whatever it is. You know, sometimes it's kind of a little bit mean, but it's not the same as a group of non-Asian people laughing at Asian people. That's totally different. And that's, you know, it's like the ownership of certain expressions. Yeah. One thinks of gay men just co-opting the word queer, which was thrown at them disparagingly before. And there are many other examples of similar terms. Which brings me on to another thing, very, very high profile ad during the Super Bowl from a candidate for the U.S. Senate, Pete Hoekstra, who, I don't know if you saw this, Carol.
I did.
But yeah, it's, for anybody who didn't see it, well, let me give you a sense of what it is. So the image you're seeing is of a 20-something Asian woman in a rural setting in the background, and here it is.
Thank you, Michigan Senator Debbie Spendetnow. Debbie spends so much American money. You borrow more and more from us. Your economy get very weak. Ours get very good. We take your jobs. Thank you, Debbie Spendetnow.
So there she is, not speaking English very well. The Debbie Spendetnow that she refers to is the sitting U.S. Senator from Michigan, Debbie Stabenow. And as soon as that aired, the ad got into trouble all over.
Angry Asian Man was all over it.
Angry Asian Man, among many, many others. There was people pointed out that there were a lot of linguistic problems with the presentation. Firstly, she didn't really sound like a Chinese person trying to speak English. And then the website where people were directed to go had a lot of bad Chinese in it, or Chinese that was at least not idiomatic. It also used traditional characters that, of course, are not used on mainland China, which somewhat undermined the point that the ad was trying to make. And that website got taken down. And then just more recently, the actress who played this fictional Chinese woman standing in front of the camera, her name is Lisa Chan. She was referred to in HTML code when I guess the political operatives who were behind this were putting it up. She was referred to as Yellow Girl.
Oof.
Yeah. Anyway, she issued an apology. Here's what she said. I am deeply sorry for any pain that the character I portrayed brought to my communities. This, she was writing this on her Facebook page. I mean, this is where we all issue everything, right? On our Facebook pages. As a recent college grad who has spent time working to improve communities and empower those without a voice, this role is not in any way representative of who I am. It was absolutely a mistake on my own part, and over time, I hope I can be forgiven. I feel horrible about my participation, and I'm determined to resolve my actions. And there have been other stories that suggest that the ad has backfired in other ways, that Debbie Stabenow has managed to raise a lot of money as a direct result of this, and of course any appeal to the Asian American vote in Michigan.
That's kind of gone now for Mr. Hoekstra.
Yeah. So it's difficult to tell with, as you say, the blogosphere sort of gets going on these things and there's an immediate reaction when this stuff takes place. Is it a question of there being more of these linguistic and racial stereotypes, or is it a question of all of us noticing them an awful lot more and kind of jumping all over them when they take place? What do you think?
It's hard to say. I mean, from my memory, I don't watch a lot of TV. Not because I'm pure. I watch just really cheesy TV. So I couldn't judge overall if there are more Asian characters than there used to be. I just don't know.
Mm.
But there definitely is more policing, and it gets a much more instant response. Even if it's the blogosphere, you just can't ignore this stuff. It's just where the conversation's happening, and you've got to respond.
Right, right. Okay, well, on to story number one, and we're going to stay in the entertainment area. This is actually a relatively old story, but it's pertinent now because it's Oscar-related, and the Oscars are coming up, the Academy Awards. And this is a movie that back in the fall was deemed not to be eligible for the foreign language category. Here's a little trailer for the movie.
Yo te aseguro que Rosalinda va a aparecer por ahí, si no es hoy mañana.
¿Han visto Rosalinda?
Oye, Correa.
¿Qué sé yo?
So this movie is called America, and it is, as you can tell, predominantly foreign language film. But the problem is not the language, it is where it was filmed, and I guess who paid for it. This is a Puerto Rican film, and as you know, Puerto Rico is part of the U.S., it's territory of the United States. And so as a result of this, it was not considered. I don't know if this is now a term of art, but let me just cite Rule 14. The Oscars. Quote, a foreign language film is defined as a feature-length motion picture produced outside the United States of America with a predominantly non-English dialogue track. So I guess this film is fine as far as the second criterion is concerned, a predominantly non-English dialogue track. But as far as the first, that's where it gets into trouble, because it was not produced outside the United States of America. The people who were involved in the movie were absolutely outraged. The director, the actors, the producers, and everything like this, they thought that the movie, of which they're, of course, very proud, and they thought that it had a real good shot at the mm-hmm. Oscar, they were outraged because, you know, we all think of this as the foreign language category, and yet somehow something that is a foreign language is now not allowed. I was sort of drawn to this story because there's this wonderful irony that places them with the same take on the Spanish language and on Puerto Rico as supporters of official English mm-hmm. in the United States, who also regard Spanish, of course, as a foreign language and are constantly bemoaning the fact that it's becoming sort of semi-official and all of this. And somehow they find themselves all sort of in the same basket. It just seems amusing more than anything else. The official English people we featured in previous podcasts are very nervous about the status of Puerto Rico and nervous lest it should ever become a state, because Spanish is the language of instruction in the schools and it is the lingua franca. It is the, for want of a better term, the official language. And so it exposes all of these strange fissures of history and also the strange ruling that the Academy Awards.
Is there any precedent for it? I mean, has there been any other Spanish language Puerto Rican film that?
Yes. 11 Puerto Rican films have been submitted before to the Academy. Just one of them, in 1990, earned a Best Foreign Language Film nomination. That was the year that Cinema Paradiso won. But there are now people who are... This has gone way beyond just the producers to people who are interested in protecting Puerto Rican heritage, demanding that a film that would otherwise, you know, is not likely to make it into some of the more mainstream categories, why they would be not allowed in this foreign language category. And also the other thing is Puerto Rico does have some representation in other spheres. Like you have, when there are international basketball tournaments, baseball, and when they had the World Series of Baseball, I think I'm right in saying that Puerto Rico had a team. And so there are certain areas in which they are allowed to compete as a nation, essentially.
Yes.
But somehow here they're not. And it just is a mirror on the awkward status that Puerto Rico has.
And so I assume the producers think this will going to limit distribution of it as well.
Hugely.
Yeah.
This is now a movie that is not going to get its moment in English language primetime. I'm not going to talk about any of the foreign language nominees that are actually up for the Oscar.
I don't even know any. I haven't even looked.
Good luck to all of them anyway. And I guess people outside Puerto Rico will be watching.
That's right.
Well, Carol, thank you very much again. That was a lot of fun.
Always a pleasure, Patrick.
Well, and tell us what's on the cartoon beat right now.
Well, it's an ongoing saga of Syria cartoons and poor Greece. And we occasionally throw in a new superhero, like a new superhero battling evil in Congo.
Oh, that's awesome.
A whole new comic strip. So there's lots of cool stuff happening.
Oh, that's great. And that is at?
That is at theworld.org/cartoons.
Great. Well, we'll check it out and talk to you again soon.
All right.
Cartoon Queen, Carol Hills. I'll post all relevant articles and blog posts of everything Carol and I talked about today at theworld.org/language. You can post your comments there or at the World in Words Facebook page, or you can tweet me. My handle is Patrick Cox, PatriCox. See you next week.
Whoopin' snacker, upscuttle, strubbly, and swivet.
Schnickelfritz.